How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Chapter 6 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar, Chapter 6, A Pendant World. The Mahar set me free as they had promised, but with strict injunctions never to approach Phutra or any other Mahar city. They also made it perfectly plain that they considered me a dangerous creature, and that, having wiped the slate clean insofar as they were under obligations to me, they now considered me fair prey. Should I again fall into their hands, they intimated it would go ill with me. They would not tell me in which direction Hooja had set forth with Dian, so I departed from Phutra, filled with bitterness against the Mahars and rage toward the Sly One, who had once again robbed me of my greatest treasure. At first I was minded to go directly back to Anorak, but upon second thought turned my face toward Sari, as I felt that somewhere in that direction Hooja would travel, his own country lying in that general direction. Of my journey to Sari it is only necessary to say that it was fraught with the usual excitement and adventure, incident to all travel across the face of savage Pellucidar. The dangers, however, were greatly reduced through the medium of my armament. I often wondered how it had happened that I had ever survived the first 10 years of my life within the inner world, when, naked and primitively armed, I had traversed great areas of her beast-ridden surface. With the aid of my map, which I had kept with great care during my march with the Sagoths in search of the great secret, I arrived at Sari at last. As I topped the lofty plateau in whose rocky cliffs the principal tribe of Sarians find their cave homes, a great hue and cry arose from those who first discovered me. Like wasps from their nests, the hairy warriors poured from their caves. The bows with their poison-tipped arrows, which I had taught them to fashion and to use, were raised against me. Swords of hammered iron, another of my innovations, menaced me, as with lusty shouts the horde charged down. It was a critical moment. Before I should be recognized, I might be dead. It was evident that all semblance of intertribal relationship had ceased with my going, and that my people had reverted to their former savage, suspicious hatred of all strangers. My garb must have puzzled them too, for never before, of course, had they seen a man clothed in khaki and puttees. Leaning my express rifle against my body, I raised both hands aloft. It was the peace sign that is recognized everywhere upon the surface of Pellucidar. The charging warriors paused and surveyed me. I looked for my friend Gak, the Hairy One, King of Sari, and presently I saw him coming from a distance. Ah, but it was good to see his mighty hairy form once more. A friend was Gak, a friend well worth the having, and it had been some time since I had seen a friend. Shouldering his way through the throng of warriors, the mighty chieftain advanced toward me. There was an expression of puzzlement upon his fine features. He crossed the space between the warriors and myself, halting before me. I did not speak. I did not even smile. I wanted to see if Gak, my principal lieutenant, would recognize me. For some time he stood there, looking me over carefully. His eyes took in my large pith helmet, my khaki jacket, and bandoliers of cartridges, the two revolvers swinging at my hips, the large rifle resting against my body. Still I stood with my hands above my head. He examined my puttees and my strong tan shoes, a little the worse for wear now. Then he glanced up once more to my face. As his gaze rested there, quite steadily for some moments, I saw recognition tinged with awe creep across his countenance. Presently, without a word, he took one of my hands in his, and dropping to one knee, raised my fingers to his lips. Parry had taught him this trick, nor ever did the most polished courtier of all the grand courts of Europe perform the little act of homage with greater grace and dignity. Quickly I raised Ghak to his feet, clasping both his hands in mine. I think there must have been tears in my eyes then. I know I felt too full for words. The King of Sari turned toward his warriors. "Our Emperor has come back," he announced. "Come hither and—" But he got no further, for the shouts that broke from those savage throats would have drowned the voice of heaven itself. I had never guessed how much they thought of me. As they clustered around, almost fighting for the chance to kiss my hand, I saw again the vision of empire which I had thought faded forever. With such as these I could conquer a world. With such as these I would conquer one. If the Sarians had remained loyal, so too would the Amazites be loyal still, and the Kalians and the Suevians, and all the great tribes who had formed the federation that was to emancipate the human race of Pellucidar. Parry was safe with the Mesops. I was safe with the Sarians. Now if Dean were but safe with me, the future would look bright indeed. It did not take long to outline to Ghak all that had befallen me since I had departed from Pellucidar, and to get down to the business of finding Dean, which to me at that moment was of even greater importance than the very empire itself. When I told him that Hooja had stolen her, he stamped his foot in rage. "It is always the sly one!" he cried. "It was Hooja who caused the first trouble between you and the beautiful one. It was Hooja who betrayed our trust and all but caused our recapture by the Sagoths that time we escaped from Phutra. It was Hooja who tricked you and substituted a Mahar for Dian when you started upon your return journey to your own world. It was Hooja who schemed and lied until he had turned the kingdoms one against another and destroyed the Federation. When we had him in our power, we were foolish to let him live. Next time—" Ghak did not need to finish his sentence. "He has become a very powerful enemy now," I replied. "That he is allied in some way with the Mahars is evidenced by the familiarity of his relations with the Sagoths, who are accompanying me in search of the great secret, for it must have been Hooja whom I saw conversing with them just before we reached the valley. Doubtless they told him of our quest, and he hastened on ahead of us, discovered the cave, and stole the document. Well does he deserve his appellation of the Sly One." With Ghak and his headmen I held a number of consultations. The upshot of them was a decision to combine our search for Dian with an attempt to rebuild the crumbled Federation. To this end 20 warriors were dispatched in pairs to 10 of the leading kingdoms, with instructions to make every effort to discover the whereabouts of Hooja and Dian, while prosecuting their missions to the chieftains to whom they were sent. Ghak was to remain at home to receive the various delegations which we invited to come to Sari on the business of the Federation. 400 warriors were started for Anorak to fetch Parry and the contents of the Prospector to the capital of the Empire, which was also the principal settlements of the Sarians. At first it was intended that I remain at Sari, that I might be in readiness to hasten forth at the first report of the discovery of Dian. But I found the inaction in the face of my deep solicitude for the welfare of my mate so galling that scarce had the several units departed upon their missions before I, too, chafed to be actively engaged upon the search. It was after my second sleep, subsequent to the departure of the warriors, as I recall, that I at last went to Ghak with the admission that I could no longer support the intolerable longing to be personally upon the trail of my lost love. Ghak tried to dissuade me, though I could tell that his heart was with me in my wish to be away and really doing something. It was while we were arguing upon the subject that a stranger, with hands above his head, entered the village. He was immediately surrounded by warriors and conducted to Ghak's presence. The fellow was a typical caveman, squat, muscular, and hairy, and of a type I had not seen before. His features, like those of all the primeval men of Pellucidar, were regular and fine. His weapons consisted of a stone axe and knife and a heavy knobbed bludgeon of wood. His skin was very white. "Who are you?" asked Ghak. "And whence come you?" "I am Kolk, son of Gurk, who is chief of the Thurians," replied the stranger. "From Thuria I have come in search of the land of Amoz, where dwells Dakor the Strong One, who stole my sister Kanda, the Graceful One, to be his mate. We of Thuria have heard of a great chieftain who has bound together many tribes, and my father has sent me to Dakor to learn if there be truth in these stories, and if so, to offer the services of Thuria to him whom we have heard called Emperor." "The stories are true," replied Ghak, "and here is the Emperor of whom you have heard. You need travel no farther." Kolk was delighted. He told us much of the wonderful resources of Thuria, the land of awful shadow, and of his long journey in search of Amoz. "And why," I asked, "does Gurk, your father, desire to join his kingdom to the Empire?" "There are two reasons," replied the young man. "Forever have the Mahars, who dwell beyond the Lidi plains which lie at the farther rim of the land of awful shadow, taken heavy toll of our people, whom they either force into lifelong slavery or fatten for their feasts. We have heard that the great Emperor makes successful war upon the Mahars, against whom we should be glad to fight. Recently has another reason come. Upon a great island which lies in the Sojar Az, but a short distance from our shores, a wicked man has collected a great band of outcast warriors of all tribes. Even are there many Sagoths among them, sent by the Mahars to aid the Wicked One. This band makes raids upon our villages, and it is constantly growing in size and strength, for the Mahars give liberty to any of their male prisoners who will promise to fight with this band against the enemies of the Mahars. It is the purpose of the Mahars thus to raise a force of our own kind to combat the growth and menace of the new Empire, of which I have come to seek information. All this we learned from one of our own warriors, who had pretended to sympathize with this band and had then escaped at the first opportunity." "Who could this man be," I asked Ghak, "who leads so vile a movement against his own kind?" "His name is Hooja," spoke up Kolk, answering my question. Ghak and I looked at each other. Relief was written upon his countenance, and I know that it was beating strongly in my heart. At last we had discovered a tangible clue to the whereabouts of Hooja, and, with the clue, a guide. But when I broached the subject to Kolk, he demurred. He had come a long way, he explained, to see his sister and to confer with Dakor. Moreover, he had instructions from his father which he could not ignore lightly. But even so, he would return with me and show me the way to the island of the Thurian shore, if by doing so we might accomplish anything. "But we cannot," he urged. "Hooja is powerful. He has thousands of warriors. He has only to call upon his Mahar allies to receive a countless horde of Sagoths to do his bidding against his human enemies. Let us wait until you may gather an equal horde from the kingdoms of your empire. Then we may march against Hooja with some show of success. But first you must lure him to the mainland, for who among you knows how to construct the strange things that carry Hooja and his band back and forth across the water? We are not island people. We do not go upon the water. We know nothing of such things." I couldn't persuade him to do more than direct me upon the way. I showed him my map, which now included a great area of country extending from Anorak upon the east to Sari upon the west, and from the river south of the Mountains of the Clouds north to Amoz. As soon as I had explained it to him, he drew a line with his finger, showing a seacoast far to the west and south of Sari, and a great circle which he said marked the extent of the land of awful shadow in which lay Thuria. The shadow extended southeast of the coast out into the sea halfway to a large island, which he said was the seat of Hooja's traitorous government. The island itself lay in the light of the noonday sun. Northwest of the coast and embracing a part of Thuria lay the Leedy Plains, upon the northwest verge of which was situated the Mahar city which took such heavy toll of the Thurians. Thus were the unhappy people now between two fires, with Hooja upon one side and the Mahars upon the other. I did not wonder that they sent out an appeal for succor. Though Gak and Kolk both attempted to dissuade me, I was determined to set out at once, nor did I delay longer than to make a copy of my map to be given to Parry that he might add to his that which I had set down since we parted. I left a letter for him as well, in which, among other things, I advanced the theory that the Sojar Az, or Great Sea, which Kolk mentioned as stretching eastward from Thuria, might indeed be the same mighty ocean as that which, swinging around the southern end of a continent, ran northward along the shore opposite Phutra, mingling its waters with the huge gulf upon which lay Sari, Amaz, and Greenwich. Against this possibility I urged him to hasten the building of a fleet of small sailing vessels, which we might utilize should I find it impossible to entice Hooja's horde to the mainland. I told Gak what I had written, and suggested that, as soon as he could, he should make new treaties with the various kingdoms of the Empire, collect an army, and march toward Thuria, this, of course, against the possibility of my detention through some cause or other. Kolk gave me a sign to his father. A Leedy, or beast of burden, crudely scratched upon a bit of bone, and beneath the Leedy a man and a flower, all very rudely done, perhaps, but none the less effective, as I knew well from my long years among the primitive men of Pellucidar. The Leedy is the tribal beast of the Thurians. The man and the flower, in the combination in which they appeared, bore a double significance, as they constituted not only a message to the effect that the bearer came in peace, but were also Kolk's signature. And so, armed with my credentials and my small arsenal, I set out alone upon my quest for the dearest girl in this world or yours. Kolk gave me explicit directions, though with my map I do not believe that I could have gone wrong. As a matter of fact, I did not need the map at all, since the principal landmark of the first half of my journey, a gigantic mountain peak, was plainly visible from Sari, though a good 100 miles away. At the southern base of this mountain a river rose and ran in a westerly direction, finally turning south and emptying into the Sojar Az, some 40 miles northeast of Thuria. All that I had to do was follow this river to the sea and then follow the coast to Thuria. 240 miles of wild mountain and primeval jungle, of untracked plain, of nameless rivers, of deadly swamps and savage forests lay ahead of me. Yet never had I been more eager for an adventure than now, for never had more depended upon haste and success. I do not know how long a time that journey required, and only half did I appreciate the varied wonders that each new march unfolded before me, for my mind and heart were filled with but a single image, that of a perfect girl whose great, dark eyes looked bravely forth from a frame of raven hair. It was not until I had passed the high peak and found the river that my eyes first discovered the pendant world, the tiny satellite which hangs low over the surface of Pellucidar, casting its perpetual shadow always upon the same spot, the area that is known here as the Land of Awful Shadow, in which dwells the tribe of Thuria. From the distance and the elevation of the highlands where I stood, the Pellucidarian noonday moon showed half in sunshine and half in shadow, while directly beneath it was plainly visible the round dark spot upon the surface of Pellucidar where the sun has never shone. From where I stood, the moon appeared to hang so low above the ground as almost to touch it, but later I was to learn that it floats a mile above the surface, which seems indeed quite close for a moon. Following the river downward, I soon lost sight of the tiny planet as I entered the mazes of a lofty forest. nor did I catch another glimpse of it for some time, several marches at least. However, when the river led me to the sea, or rather just before it reached the sea, of a sudden the sky became overcast, and the size and luxuriance of the vegetation diminished as by magic, as if an omnipotent hand had drawn a line upon the earth and said, "Upon this side shall the trees and the shrubs, the grasses and the flowers, riot in profusion of rich colors, gigantic size and bewildering abundance, and upon that side shall they be dwarfed and pale and scant." Instantly I looked above, for clouds are so uncommon in the skies of Pellucidar, they are practically unknown except above the mightiest mountain ranges, that it had given me something of a start to discover the sun obliterated. But I was not long in coming to a realization of the cause of the shadow. Above me hung another world. I could see its mountains and valleys, oceans, lakes and rivers, its broad grassy plains and dense forests. But too great was the distance and too deep the shadow of its underside for me to distinguish any movement as of animal life. Instantly a great curiosity was awakened within me. The questions which the sight of this planet, so tantalizingly close, raised in my mind were numerous and unanswerable. Was it inhabited? If so, by what manner and form of creature? Were its people as relatively diminutive as their little world, or were they as disproportionately huge as the lesser attraction of gravity upon the surface of their globe would permit of their being? As I watched it, I saw that it was revolving upon an axis that lay parallel to the surface of Pellucidar, so that during each revolution its entire surface was once exposed to the world below and once bathed in the heat of the great sun above. The little world had that which Pellucidar could not have, a day and night, and, greatest of boons to one outer earthly born, time. Here I saw a chance to give time to Pellucidar, using this mighty clock, revolving perpetually in the heavens, to record the passage of the hours for the earth below. Here should be located an observatory, from which might be flashed by wireless to every corner of the empire the correct time once each day. That this time would be easily measured I had no doubt, since so plain were the landmarks upon the undersurface of the satellite that it would be but necessary to erect a simple instrument and mark the instant of passage of a given landmark across the instrument. But then was not the time for dreaming. I must devote my mind to the purpose of my journey. So I hastened onward beneath the great shadow. As I advanced I could not but note the changing nature of the vegetation and the paling of its hues. The river led me a short distance within the shadow before it emptied into the Sojar Az. Then I continued in a southerly direction along the coast toward the village of Thuria, where I hoped to find Gurk and deliver to him my credentials. I had progressed no great distance from the mouth of the river when I discerned, lying some distance at sea, a great island. This I assumed to be the stronghold of Hooja, nor did I doubt that upon it even now was Dian. The way was most difficult, since shortly after leaving the river I encountered lofty cliffs split by numerous long, narrow fjords, each of which necessitated a considerable detour. As the crow flies, it is about 20 miles from the mouth of the river to Thuria, but before I had covered half of it I was fagged. There was no familiar fruit or vegetable growing upon the rocky soil of the cliff-tops, and I would have fared ill for food had not a hair broken cover almost beneath my nose. I carried bow and arrows to conserve my ammunition supply, but so quick was the little animal that I had no time to draw and fit a shaft. In fact, my dinner was 100 yards away, and going like the proverbial bat when I dropped my six-shooter on it. It was a pretty shot, and when coupled with a good dinner, made me quite contented with myself. After eating, I lay down and slept. When I awoke, I was scarcely so self-satisfied, for I had not more than opened my eyes before I became aware of the presence, barely 100 yards from me, of a pack of some 20 huge wolf-dogs, the things which Parry insisted upon calling hyaenodons, and almost simultaneously I discovered that while I slept, my revolvers, rifle, bow, arrows, and knife had been stolen from me. And the wolf-dog pack was preparing to rush me. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 7. From Plight to Plight. I have never been much of a runner. I hate running. But if ever a sprinter broke into smithereens all world's records, it was I that day, when I fled before those hideous beasts along the narrow spit of rocky cliff between two narrow fjords toward the Sojar As. Just as I reached the verge of the cliff, the foremost of the brutes was upon me. He leapt and closed his massive jaws upon my shoulder. The momentum of his flying body, added to that of my own, carried the two of us over the cliff. It was a hideous fall. The cliff was almost perpendicular. At its foot broke the sea against a solid wall of rock. We struck the cliff face once in our descent, and then plunged into the salt sea. With the impact with the water, the hyaenodon released his hold upon my shoulder. As I came sputtering to the surface, I looked about for some tiny foot or handhold where I might cling for a moment of rest and recuperation. The cliff itself offered me nothing, so I swam toward the mouth of the fjord. At the far end I could see that erosion from above had washed down sufficient rubble to form a narrow ribbon of beach. Toward this I swam with all my strength. Not once did I look behind me, since every unnecessary movement in swimming detracts so much from one's endurance speed. Not until I had drawn myself safely out upon the beach did I turn my eyes toward the sea for the hyaenodon. He was swimming slowly and apparently painfully toward the beach upon where I stood. I watched him for a long time, wondering why it was that such a dog-like animal was not a better swimmer. As he neared me, I realized that he was weakening rapidly. I had gathered a handful of stones to be ready for his assault when he landed, but in a moment I let them fall from my hands. It was evident that the brute either was no swimmer or else was severely injured, for by now he was making practically no headway. Indeed, it was with quite apparent difficulty that he kept his nose above the surface of the sea. He was not more than 50 yards from shore when he went under. I watched the spot where he had disappeared, and in a moment saw his head reappear. The look of dumb misery in his eyes struck a chord in my breast, for I love dogs. I forgot that he was a vicious, primordial wolf-thing, a man-eater, a scourge, and a terror. I saw only the sad eyes that looked like the eyes of Raja, my dead collie of the outer world. I did not stop to weigh and consider. In other words, I did not stop to think, which I believe must be the way of men who do things, in contradistinction to those who think much and do nothing. Instead, I leapt back into the water and swam out toward the drowning beast. At first he showed his teeth at my approach, but just before I reached him he went under for the second time, so that I had to dive to get him. I grabbed him by the scruff of the neck, and though he weighed as much as a Shetland pony, I managed to drag him to shore and well up upon the beach. Here I found that one of his forelegs was broken. The crash against the cliff face must have done it. By this time all the fight was out of him, so that when I had gathered a few tiny branches from some of the stunted trees that grew in the crevices of the cliff and returned to him, he permitted me to set his broken leg and bind it in splints. I had to tear part of my shirt into bits to obtain a bandage, but at last the job was done. Then I sat stroking the savage head and talking to the beast in the man-dog talk with which you are familiar, if you have ever owned and loved a dog. When he is well, I thought, he probably will turn upon me and attempt to devour me, and against that eventuality I gathered together a pile of rocks and set to work to fashion a stone knife. We were bottled up at the head of the fjord as completely as if we had been behind prison bars. Before us spread the Sojar Az, and elsewhere about us rose unscalable cliffs. Fortunately, a little rivulet trickled down the side of the rocky wall, giving us ample supply of fresh water, some of which I kept constantly beside the Hyaenodon in a huge bowl-shaped shell, of which there were countless numbers among the rubble of the beach. For food we subsisted upon shellfish and an occasional bird that I succeeded in knocking over with a rock, for long practice as a pitcher on prep school and varsity nines had made me an excellent shot with a hand-thrown missile. It was not long before the Hyaenodon's leg was sufficiently mended to permit him to rise and hobble about on three legs. I shall never forget with what intent interest I watched his first attempt. Close at my hand lay my pile of rocks. Slowly the beast came to his three good feet. He stretched himself, lowered his head, and lapped water from the drinking shell at his side, turned and looked at me, and then hobbled off toward the cliffs. Thrice he traversed the entire extent of our prison, seeking, I imagine, a loophole for escape, but finding none, he returned in my direction. Slowly he came quite close to me, sniffed at my shoes, my puttees, my hands, and then limped off a few feet and lay down again. Now that he was able to get around, I was a little uncertain as to the wisdom of my impulsive mercy. How could I sleep with that ferocious thing prowling about the narrow confines of our prison? Should I close my eyes, it might be to open them again to the feel of those mighty jaws at my throat. To say the least, I was uncomfortable. I have had too much experience with dumb animals to bank very strongly on any sense of gratitude which may be attributed to them by inexperienced sentimentalists. I believe that some animals love their masters, but I doubt very much if their affection is the outcome of gratitude, a characteristic that is so rare as to be only occasionally traceable in the seemingly unselfish acts of man himself. But finally I was forced to sleep. Tired nature would be put off no longer. I simply fell asleep willy-nilly as I sat looking out to sea. I had been very uncomfortable since my ducking in the ocean, for though I could see the sunlight on the water halfway toward the island and upon the island itself, no ray of it fell upon us. We were well within the land of awful shadow. A perpetual half-warmth pervaded the atmosphere, but clothing was slow in drying, and so from loss of sleep and great physical discomfort I at last gave way to nature's demands and sank into profound slumber. When I awoke it was with a start, for a heavy body was upon me. My first thought was that the Hyaenodon had at last attacked me. But as my eyes opened and I struggled to rise, I saw that a man was astride me and three others bending close above him. I am no weakling, and never have been. My experience in the hard life of the inner world has turned my thews to steel. Even such giants as Gak the Hairy One have praised my strength, but to it is added another quality which they lack. Science. The man upon me held me down awkwardly, leaving me many openings, one of which I was not slow in taking advantage of, so that almost before the fellow knew that I was awake I was upon my feet with my arms over his shoulders and about his waist, and had hurled him heavily over my head to the hard rubble of the beach where he lay quite still. In the instant that I arose I had seen the Hyaenodon lying asleep beside a boulder a few yards away. So nearly was he the color of the rock that he was scarcely discernible. Evidently the newcomers had not seen him. I had not more than freed myself from one of my antagonists before the other three were upon me. They did not work silently now, but charged me with savage cries, a mistake upon their part. The fact that they did not draw their weapons against me convinced me that they desired to take me alive, but I fought as desperately as if death loomed immediate and sure. The battle was short, for scarce had their first wild whoop reverberated through the rocky fjord and they had closed upon me, than a hairy mass of demoniacal rage hurtled among us. It was the Hyaenodon. In an instant he had pulled down one of the men, and with a single shake, terrier-like, had broken his neck. Then he was upon another. in their efforts to vanquish the wolf-dog, the savages forgot all about me, thus giving me an instant in which to snatch a knife from the loin-string of him who had first fallen, and account for another of them. Almost simultaneously the hyaenodon pulled down the remaining enemy, crushing his skull with a single bite of those fearsome jaws. The battle was over, unless the beast considered me fair prey too. I waited, ready for him with knife and bludgeon, also filched from a dead foeman. But he paid no attention to me, falling to work instead to devour one of the corpses. The beast had been handicapped but little by his splinted leg, but having eaten, he lay down and commenced to gnaw at the bandage. I was sitting some little distance away, devouring shellfish, of which, by the way, I was becoming exceedingly tired. Presently the hyaenodon arose and came toward me. I did not move. He stopped in front of me and deliberately raised his bandaged leg and pawed my knee. His act was as intelligible as words. He wished the bandage removed. I took the great paw in one hand and with the other hand untied and unwound the bandage, removed the splints and felt of the injured member. As far as I could judge, the bone was completely knit. The joint was stiff. When I bent it a little, the brute winced, but he neither growled nor tried to pull away. Very slowly and gently I rubbed the joint and applied pressure to it for a few moments. Then I set it down upon the ground. The hyaenodon walked around me a few times, and then lay down at my side, his body touching mine. I laid my hand upon his head. He did not move. Slowly I scratched about his ears and neck and down beneath the fierce jaws. The only sign he gave was to raise his chin a trifle, that I might better caress him. That was enough. From that moment I have never again felt suspicion of Raja, as I immediately named him. Somehow all sense of loneliness vanished too. I had a dog. I had never guessed precisely what it was that was lacking to life in Pellucidar, but now I knew it was the total absence of domestic animals. Man here had not yet reached the point where he might take the time from slaughter and escaping slaughter to make friends with any of the brute creation. I must qualify this statement a trifle and say that this was true of those tribes with which I was most familiar. The Thurians do domesticate the colossal Leedi, traversing the great Leedi plains upon the backs of these grotesque and stupendous monsters. And possibly there may also be other far distant peoples within the great world who have tamed others of the wild things of jungle, plain, or mountain. The Thurians practice agriculture in a crude sort of way. It is my opinion that this is one of the earliest steps from savagery to civilization. The taming of wild beasts and their domestication follows. Perry argues that wild dogs were first domesticated for hunting purposes, but I do not agree with him. I believe that if their domestication were not purely the result of an accident, as, for example, my taming of the hyaenodon, it came about through the desire of tribes who had previously domesticated flocks and herds to have some strong, ferocious beast to guard their roaming property. However, I lean rather more strongly to the theory of accident. As I sat there upon the beach of the little fjord eating my unpalatable shellfish, I commenced to wonder how it had been that the four savages had been able to reach me, though I had been unable to escape from my natural prison. I glanced about in all directions, searching for an explanation. At last my eyes fell upon the bow of a small dugout protruding scarce a foot from behind a large boulder lying half in the water at the edge of the beach. At my discovery I leapt to my feet so suddenly that it brought Raja, growling and bristling, upon all fours in an instant. For the moment I had forgotten him, but his savage rumbling did not cause me any uneasiness. He glanced quickly about in all directions, as if searching for the cause of my excitement. Then, as I walked rapidly down toward the dugout, he slunk silently after me. The dugout was similar in many respects to those which I had seen in use by the Mesops. In it were four paddles. I was much delighted, as it promptly offered me the escape I had been craving. I pushed it out into water that would float it, stepped in and called to Raja to enter. At first he did not seem to understand what I wished of him, but after I had paddled out a few yards he plunged through the surf and swam after me. When he had come alongside, I grasped the scruff of his neck, and after a considerable struggle, in which I several times came near to overturning the canoe, I managed to drag him aboard, where he shook himself vigorously and squatted down before me. After emerging from the fjord, I paddled southward along the coast, where presently the lofty cliffs gave way to lower and more level country. It was here somewhere that I should come upon the principal village of the Thurians. When, after a time, I saw in the distance what I took to be huts in a clearing near the shore, I drew quickly into land, for though I had been furnished credentials by Kolk, I was not sufficiently familiar with the tribal characteristics of these people to know whether I should receive a friendly welcome or not, and in case I should not, I wanted to be sure of having a canoe hidden safely away so that I might undertake the trip to the island in any event, provided, of course, that I escaped the Thurians should they prove belligerent. At the point where I landed, the shore was quite low. A forest of pale, scrubby ferns ran down almost to the beach. Here I dragged up the dugout, hiding it well within the vegetation, and with some loose rocks built a cairn upon the beach to mark my cache. Then I turned my steps toward the Thurian village. As I proceeded, I began to speculate upon the possible actions of Raja when we should enter the presence of other men than myself. The brute was padding softly at my side, his sensitive nose constantly a twitch, and his fierce eyes moving restlessly from side to side. Nothing would ever take Raja unawares. The more I thought upon the matter, the greater became my perturbation. I did not want Raja to attack any of the people upon whose friendship I so greatly depended, nor did I want him injured or slain by them. I wondered if Raja would stand for a leash. His head, as he paced beside me, was level with my hip. I laid my hand upon it caressingly. As I did so, he turned and looked up into my face, his jaws parting and his red tongue lolling as you have seen your own dogs beneath a love-pat. "Just been waiting all your life to be tamed and loved, haven't you, old man?" I asked. "You're nothing but a good pup, and the man who put the hyeno in your name ought to be sued for libel." Raja bared his mighty fangs with upcurled, snarling lips and licked my hand. "You're grinning, you old fraud, you!" I cried. "If you're not, I'll eat you. I'll bet a doughnut you're nothing but some kid's poor old Fido, masquerading around as a real live man-eater." Raja whined, and so we walked on together toward Thuria, I talking to the beast at my side, and he seeming to enjoy my company no less than I enjoyed his. If you don't think it's lonesome wandering all by yourself through savage, unknown Pellucidar, why, just try it, and you will not wonder that I was glad of the company of this first dog, this living replica of the fierce and now extinct hyaenodon of the outer crust, that hunted in savage packs the great elk across the snows of southern France, in the days when the mastodon roamed at will over the broad continent of which the British Isles were then a part, and perchance left his footprints and his bones in the sands of Atlantis as well. Thus I dreamed as we moved on toward Thuria. My dreaming was rudely shattered by a savage growl from Raja. I looked down at him. He had stopped in his tracks as one turned to stone. A thin ridge of stiff hair bristled along the entire length of his spine. His yellow-green eyes were fastened upon the scrubby jungle at our right. I fastened my fingers in the bristles at his neck and turned my eyes in the direction that his pointed. At first I saw nothing. Then a slight movement of the bushes riveted my attention. I thought it must be some wild beast, and was glad of the primitive weapons I had taken from the bodies of the warriors who had attacked me. Presently I distinguished two eyes peering at us from the vegetation. I took a step in their direction, and as I did so, a youth arose and fled precipitately in the direction we had been going. Raja struggled to be after him, but I held tightly to his neck, an act which he did not seem to relish, for he turned on me with bared fangs. I determined that now was as good a time as any to discover just how deep was Roger's affection for me. One of us could be master, and logically I was the one. He growled at me. I cuffed him sharply across the nose. He looked at me for a moment in surprised bewilderment, and then he growled again. I made another feint at him, expecting that it would bring him at my throat. But instead he winced and crouched down. Raja was subdued. I stooped and patted him. Then I took a piece of the rope that constituted a part of my equipment and made a leash for him. Thus we resumed our journey toward Thuria. The youth who had seen us was evidently of the Thurians. That he had lost no time in racing homeward and spreading the word of my coming was evidenced when we had come within sight of the clearing and the village, the first real village, by the way, that I had ever seen constructed by human Pellucidarians. There was a rude rectangle walled with logs and boulders, in which were a hundred or more thatched huts of similar construction. There was no gate. Ladders that could be removed by night led over the palisade. Before the village were assembled a great concourse of warriors. Inside I could see the heads of women and children peering over the top of the wall, and also, farther back, the long necks of Lidi topped by their tiny heads. Lidi, by the way, is both the singular and plural form of the noun that describes the huge beasts of burden of the Thurians. They were enormous quadrupeds, 80 or 100 feet long, with very small heads perched at the top of very long, slender necks. Their heads were quite 40 feet from the ground. Their gait is slow and deliberate, but so enormous are their strides that, as a matter of fact, they cover the ground quite rapidly. Perry has told me that they are almost identical with the fossilized remains of the Diplodocus of the outer crust Jurassic Age. I have to take his word for it, and I guess you will, unless you know more of such matters than I. As we came in sight of the warriors, the men set up a great jabbering. Their eyes were wide in astonishment, only, I presume, because of my strange garmenture, but as well from the fact that I came in company with a Jalok, which is the Pellucidarian name of the Hyaenodon. Raja tugged at his leash, growling and showing his long white fangs. He would have liked nothing better than to be at the throats of the whole aggregation. But I held him in with the leash, though it took all my strength to do it. My free hand I held above my head, palm out, in token of the peacefulness of my mission. In the foreground I saw the youth who had discovered us, and I could tell from the way he carried himself that he was quite overcome by his own importance. The warriors about him were all fine-looking fellows, though shorter and squatter than the Saurians or the Amozites. Their color, too, was a bit lighter, owing, no doubt, to the fact that much of their lives is spent within the shadow of the world that hangs forever above their country. A little in advance of the others was a bearded fellow, tricked out in many ornaments. I didn't need to ask to know that he was the chieftain, doubtless Gurk, father of Kolk. Now to him I addressed myself. "I am David," I said, "Emperor of the Federated Kingdoms of Pellucidar. Doubtless you have heard of me?" He nodded his head affirmatively. "I come from Sari," I continued, "where I just met Kolk, the son of Gurk. I bear a token from Kolk to his father, which will prove that I am a friend." Again the warrior nodded. "I am Gurk," he said. "Where is the token?" "Here," I replied, and fished into the game bag where I had placed it. Gurk and his people waited in silence. My hand searched the inside of the bag. It was empty. The token had been stolen with my arms. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 8. Captive. When Gurk and his people saw that I had no token, they commenced to taunt me. "You do not come from Kolk, but from the Sly One," they cried. "He has sent you from the island to spy upon us.
Go away, or we will set upon you and kill you."
I explained that all my belongings had been stolen from me, and that the robber must have taken the token too, but they didn't believe me. As proof that I was one of Hooja's people, they pointed to my weapons, which they said were ornamented like those of the Island Clan. Further, they said that no good man went in company with a Jalak, and that by this line of reasoning I certainly was a bad man. I saw that they were not naturally a warlike tribe, for they preferred that I leave in peace rather than force them to attack me, whereas the Sarians would have killed a suspicious stranger first and inquired into his purposes later. I think Raja sensed their antagonism, for he kept tugging at his leash and growling ominously. They were a bit in awe of him and kept at a safe distance. It was evident that they could not comprehend why it was that this savage brute did not turn upon me and rend me. I wasted a long time there trying to persuade Gurk to accept me at my own valuation, but he was too canny. The best he would do was to give us food, which he did, and direct me as to the safest portion of the island upon which to attempt a landing, though even as he told me I am sure that he thought my request for information but a blind to deceive him as to my true knowledge of the insular stronghold. At last I turned away from them, rather disheartened, for I had hoped to be able to enlist a considerable force of them in an attempt to rush Hooja's horde and rescue Dian. Back along the beach toward the hidden canoe we made our way. By the time we came to the cairn I was dog-tired. Throwing myself upon the sand, I soon slept, and with Raja stretched out beside me, I felt a far greater security than I had enjoyed for a long time. I awoke much refreshed to find Raja's eyes glued upon me. The moment I opened mine, he rose, stretched himself, and without a backward glance, plunged into the jungle. For several minutes I could hear him crashing through the brush. Then all was silent. I wondered if he had left me to return to his fierce pack. A feeling of loneliness overwhelmed me. With a sigh I turned to the work of dragging the canoe down to the sea. As I entered the jungle where the dugout lay, a hare darted from beneath the boat's side, and a well-aimed cast of my javelin brought it down. I was hungry. I had not realized it before. So I sat upon the edge of the canoe and devoured my repast. The last remnants gone, I again busied myself with preparations for my expedition to the island. I did not know for certain that Dian was there, but I surmised as much, nor could I guess what obstacles might confront me in an effort to rescue her. For a time I loitered about after I had the canoe at the water's edge, hoping against hope that Raja would return. But he did not. So I shoved the awkward craft through the surf and leapt into it. I was still a little downcast by the desertion of my new-found friend, though I tried to assure myself that it was nothing but what I might have expected. The savage brute had served me well in the short time that we had been together, and had repaid his debt of gratitude to me, since he had saved my life, or at least my liberty, no less certainly than I had saved his life when he was injured and drowning. The trip across the water to the island was uneventful. I was mighty glad to be in the sunshine again when I passed out of the shadow of the dead world about halfway between the mainland and the island. The hot rays of the noonday sun did a great deal toward raising my spirits, and dispelling the mental gloom in which I had been shrouded almost continually since entering the land of awful shadow. There is nothing more dispiriting to me than the absence of sunshine. I had paddled to the southwestern point, which Gurk said he believed to be the least frequented portion of the island, as he had never seen boats put off from there. I found a shallow reef running far out into the sea, and rather precipitous cliffs running almost to the surf. It was a nasty place to land, and I realize now why it was not used by the natives. But at last I managed, after a good wetting, to beach my canoe and scale the cliffs. The country beyond them appeared more open and park-like than I had anticipated, since from the mainland the entire coast that is visible seems densely clothed with tropical jungle. This jungle, as I could see from the vantage point of the cliff-top, formed but a relatively narrow strip between the sea and the more open forest and meadow of the interior. Farther back there was a range of low but apparently very rocky hills, and here and there, all about, were visible flat-topped masses of rock, small mountains in fact, which reminded me of pictures I had seen of landscapes in New Mexico. Altogether, the country was very much broken and very beautiful. From where I stood, I counted no less than a dozen streams winding down from among the table buttes and emptying into a pretty river which flowed away in a northeasterly direction toward the opposite end of the island. As I let my eyes roam over the scene, I suddenly became aware of figures moving upon the flat top of a far distant butte. Whether they were beast or human, though, I could not make out, but at least they were alive, so I determined to prosecute my search for Hooja's stronghold in the general direction of this butte. To descend to the valley required no great effort. As I swung along through the lush grass and the fragrant flowers, my cudgel swinging in my hand and my javelin looped across my shoulders with its aurochs hide strap, I felt equal to any emergency, ready for any danger. I had covered quite a little distance, and I was passing through a strip of wood which lay at the foot of one of the flat-topped hills, when I became conscious of the sensation of being watched. My life within Pellucidar has rather quickened my senses of sight, hearing, and smell, and, too, certain primitive, intuitive, or instinctive qualities that seem blunted in civilized man. But though I was positive that eyes were upon me, I could see no sign of any living thing within the wood other than the many gay-plumaged birds and little monkeys which filled the trees with life, color, and action. To you it may seem that my conviction was the result of an overwrought imagination, or to the actual reality of the prying eyes of the little monkeys or the curious ones of the birds. But there is a difference which I cannot explain between the sensation of casual observation and studied espionage. A sheep might gaze at you without transmitting a warning through your subjective mind, because you are in no danger from a sheep. But let a tiger gaze fixedly at you from ambush, and unless your primitive instincts are completely calloused, you will presently commence to glance furtively about and be filled with vague, unreasoning terror. Thus it was with me then. I grasped my cudgel more firmly and unslung my javelin, carrying it in my left hand. I peered to my left and right, but I saw nothing. Then, all quite suddenly, there fell about my neck and shoulders, around my arms and body, a number of pliant fiber ropes. In a jiffy I was trussed up as neatly as you might wish. One of the nooses dropped to my ankles and was jerked up with a suddenness that brought me to my face upon the ground. Then something heavy and hairy sprang upon my back. I fought to draw my knife, but hairy hands grasped my wrists and, dragging them behind my back, bound them securely. Next my feet were bound. Then I was turned over upon my back to look up into the faces of my captors. And what faces! Imagine, if you can, a cross between a sheep and a gorilla, and you will have some conception of the physiognomy of the creature that bent close above me, and of those of the half-dozen others that clustered about. There was the facial length and great eyes of the sheep, and the bull neck and hideous fangs of the gorilla. The bodies and limbs were both man and gorilla-like. As they bent over me they conversed in a monosyllabic tongue that was perfectly intelligible to me. It was something of a simplified language that had no need for aught but nouns and verbs, but such words as it included were the same as those of the human beings of Pellucidar. It was amplified by many gestures which filled in the speech gaps. I asked them what they intended doing with me. But, like our own North American Indians, when questioned by a white man, they pretended not to understand me. One of them swung me to his shoulder as lightly as if I had been a shoat. He was a huge creature, as were his fellows, standing fully 7 feet upon his short legs and weighing considerably more than a quarter of a ton. Two went ahead of my bearer and three behind. In this order we cut to the right through the forest to the foot of the hill, where precipitous cliffs appeared to bar our further progress in this direction. But my escort never paused. Like ants upon a wall, they scaled that seemingly unscalable barrier, clinging, heaven knows how, to its ragged perpendicular face. During most of the short journey to the summit, I must admit that my hair stood on end. Presently, however, we topped the thing and stood upon the level mesa which crowned it. Immediately, from all about, out of burrows and rough, rocky lairs, poured a perfect torrent of beasts similar to my captors. They clustered about, jabbering at my guards and attempting to get their hands upon me, whether from curiosity or a desire to do me bodily harm I did not know, since my escort with bared fangs and heavy blows kept them off. Across the mesa we went, to stop at last before a large pile of rocks in which an opening appeared. Here my guard set me upon my feet and called out a word which sounded like "Gur, gur, gur," and which I later learned was the name of their king. Presently there emerged from the cavernous depths of the lair a monstrous creature, scarred from 100 battles, almost hairless and with an empty socket where one eye had been. The other eye, sheep-like in its mildness, gave the most startling appearance to the beast, which, but for that single timid orb, was the most fearsome thing that one could imagine. I had encountered the black, hairless, long-tailed ape, things of the mainland, the creatures that Perry thought might constitute the link between the higher orders of apes and man. But these brute-men of Gur-Gur-Gur seemed to set that theory back to zero. For there was less similarity between the black ape-men and these creatures than there was between the latter and man, while both had many human attributes, some of which were better developed in one species and some in the other. The black apes were hairless and built thatched huts in their arboreal retreats. They kept domesticated dogs and ruminants, in which respect they were farther advanced than the human beings of Pellucidar. But they appeared to have only a meager language and sported long, ape-like tails. On the other hand, Gur-Gur-Gur's people were for the most part quite hairy, but they were tailless and had a language similar to that of the human race of Pellucidar. Nor were they arboreal. Their skins, where skin showed, were white. From the foregoing facts and others that I have noted during my long life within Pellucidar, which is now passing through an age analogous to some pre-glacial age of the outer crust, I am constrained to the belief that evolution is not so much a gradual transition from one form to another as it is an accident of breeding, either by crossing or the hazards of birth. In other words, it is my belief that the first man was a freak of nature, nor would one have to draw over strongly upon his credulity to be convinced that Gur-Gur-Gur and his tribe were also freaks. The great man-brute seated himself upon a flat rock, his throne, I imagine, just before the entrance to his lair. With elbows on knees and chin in palms, he regarded me intently through his lone sheep-eye, while one of my captors told of my taking. When all had been related, Gur-Gur-Gur questioned me. I shall not attempt to quote these people in their own abbreviated tongue. You would have even greater difficulty in interpreting them than did I. Instead, I shall put the words into their mouths which will carry to you the ideas which they intended to convey. "You are an enemy," was Gur-Gur-Gur's initial declaration. "You belong to the tribe of Hooja." Ah, so they knew Hooja, and he was their enemy. Good. "I am an enemy of Hooja," I replied. "He has stolen my mate, and I have come here to take her away from him and punish Hooja."
"How could you do that alone?"
"I do not know," I answered, "but I should have tried had you not captured me. What do you intend to do with me?"
"You shall work for us."
"You will not kill me?" I asked.
"We do not kill except in self-defense," he replied. "Self-defense and punishment. Those who would kill us and those who do wrong, we kill. If we knew you were one of Hooja's people, we might kill you, for all Hooja's people are bad people. But you say you are an enemy of Hooja. You may not speak the truth, but until we learn that you have lied, we shall not kill you. You shall work."
"If you hate Hooja," I suggested, "why not let me, who hate him too, go and punish him?"
For some time Gur-Gur-Gur sat in thought. Then he raised his head and addressed my guard.
"Take him to his work," he ordered.
His tone was final. As if to emphasize it, he turned and entered his burrow. My guard conducted me farther into the mesa, where we came presently to a tiny depression or valley, at one end of which gushed a warm spring. The view that opened before me was the most surprising thing I have ever seen. In the hollow, which must have covered several hundred acres, were numerous fields of growing things, and working all about with crude implements or with no implements at all other than their bare hands were many of the brute men engaged in the first agriculture that I had seen within Pellucidar. They put me to work cultivating in a patch of melons. I never was a farmer, nor particularly keen for this sort of work, but I am free to confess that time never had dragged so heavily as it did during the hour or the year I spent there at that work. How long it really was, I do not know, of course, but it was all too long. The creatures that worked about me were quite simple and friendly. One of them proved to be a son of Gur-Gur-Gur. He had broken some minor tribal law and was working out his sentence in the fields. He told me that his tribe had lived upon this hilltop always, and that there were other tribes like them dwelling upon other hilltops. They had no wars and had always lived in peace and harmony, menaced only by the larger carnivora of the island, until my kind had come under a creature called Hooja and attacked and killed them when they chanced to descend from their natural fortresses to visit their fellows upon other lofty mesas. Now they were afraid, but some day they would go in a body and fall upon Hooja and his people and slay them all. I explained to him that I was Hooja's enemy and asked, when they were ready to go, that I be allowed to go with them, or, better still, that they let me go ahead and learn all that I could about the village where Hooja dwelt, so that they might attack it with the best chance of success. Gur-Gur-Gur's son seemed much impressed by my suggestion. He said that when he was through in the fields he would speak to his father about the matter. Some time after this Gur-Gur-Gur came through the fields where we were, and his son spoke to him upon the subject, but the old gentleman was evidently in anything but a good humor, for he cuffed the youngster and, turning upon me, informed me that he was convinced that I had lied to him, and that I was one of Hooja's people. "Wherefore," he concluded, "we shall slay you as soon as the melons are cultivated. Hasten, therefore." And hasten I did. I hastened to cultivate the weeds which grew among the melon vines. Where there had been one sickly weed before, I nourished two healthy ones. When I found a particularly promising variety of weed growing elsewhere than among my melons, I forthwith dug it up and transplanted it among my charges. My masters did not seem to realize my perfidy. They saw me always laboring diligently in the melon patch, and as time enters not into the reckoning of Pellucidarians, even of human beings, and much less of brutes and half-brutes, I might have lived on indefinitely through this subterfuge had not that occurred which took me out of the melon patch for good and all.
End of chapter 8.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.